Hello, Gallatin Valley. You're listening to KGVM Bozeman on FM 95.9. This is Dr. Nurse Nancy welcoming you to Body Politic, a show about how our ability to control what we do with our bodies and what happens to our bodies shapes our life experiences. This show is a little different from most Body Politic shows because today we're in Butte at our neighbor community radio station, KBMF, 102.5 FM. From mining to prostitution to pollution, Butte has a lot of history in terms of how what happens to people's bodies shaped their life experiences. But before we go more deeply into some of that history, I'd like to start by talking with two guests. Clark Grant is station manager of KBMF, and Anne Zalda Petrie is the founding treasurer of the Butte America Foundation, which is the licensee of KBMF. She's also a founding member of KFGM 105.5 FM in Missoula. Well, as Robin Fly says, our radio station is much younger than yours, and I know there was a board of directors that worked for years, like probably more than a decade, I believe, to get this station started. And we've only been involved for 8 months or so. But Anne, you've been involved in sort of birthing two radio stations, yes? What does it take?
Wow, that's a really good question. I would say it takes a group of people who are really committed to the idea of having the station and people that are willing to follow through until it's on the air. And I don't think that's always easy to come by. I think a lot of people say they're interested, but when they find out how much work it takes, they sort of fade away. And so when you can get that group, and it only has to be four or five people really, but that are committed to it, and then to go on through the process of, you know, organizing, forming a business, getting a construction permit, getting on the air, sending out those nascent signals, getting your license, and then continuing to grow after you're already on the air, then I think you're rolling. I think the biggest challenge is funding, frankly, and those people have to be committed to fundraising as well as donating out of their own pockets, both in, you know, time and their own money. So I think that's really important too. I think in Butte, Clark was so central and has that charisma and is able to meet people, and they see the excitement around the idea because of the skillful way that he presents it. And I think also in Butte, there wasn't anything like this. So, I think that all contributed to the way that it came together here. And then the first president of the board of directors here in Butte was Amanda Curtis, who is a state legislator and very well known. And I think she had a lot to do with the way that the idea became reality here in Butte. In Missoula, we've got some competition. So there's the college radio station and there's Montana Public Radio in Missoula. So we had to not only convince people that a community radio station was an important thing for our community, but that it wasn't going to be competing with these already existing entities. So that just took a lot of discussions with different community leaders and a lot of involvement from them. We had Michael Marsalek, for example, speak at one of our first fundraisers to sort of calm any fears that we were looking to take listeners away and funding away from Montana Public Radio. But we had, from the very beginning, our general manager, John Van Dyke, was interested and put in innumerable hours on building the physical station. And we also had the vice president of the board of directors is a young man named Aaron Jennings, and he has some technical skills that were really necessary and helpful for us. And then we had some other board members that were along from the very beginning that helped choose a location and then were integral in the original rent payments and all of that. In Butte, in terms of the technical sides of it, Clark pretty much read instruction manuals and watched YouTube videos and learned how to build a station. Mm-hmm. And he did that. And we got to benefit from his experience in Missoula, because then I had seen him do all that and been there for some of it. And then we were able to apply that in Missoula. But none of these stations, and you guys know, well, maybe it's different in Bozeman, but we don't have money for an engineer.
Oh, it's not different in Bozeman.
Yeah, we're all volunteers.
So we built them. We, you know, put in the broadcast console and connected it to the transmitter and put up an antenna and connected it to the antenna and then turn it on. And everybody's listening in their cars and cheers when the signal actually works. And you sort of can't believe it after all the soldering that you did.
I burned your finger with the soldering iron. Sorry about that. Accidentally.
I don't know if that answers your question, but I think the reality is that somebody has to have the idea and the desire, and they have to be able to communicate that in a way that it catches fire, because you definitely could not do it alone.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Body Politic. I am your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. Today, I am in Butte at our sister community radio station, KBMF. I am speaking with Clark Grant, the station manager, and Anzalda Petrie, who is one of the founding members. I wanted to ask you all, since there is so much rich history in Butte, and since you are linking some of the history that's in the archives across the street with the station, could you talk to me a little bit, please, about some of the history that you have been finding and that you have shared or will be sharing?
Certainly. For me, one of the most compelling aspects of Butte's history comes not from the turn of the last century when Butte was booming, and there were 90,000 people on the hill and the underground mines were going concern globally, you know, in the commodities market. But for me, the most compelling chapter in Butte's history is the displacement of neighborhoods, Meaderville, East Butte, McQueen, even Devlin Gulch. So and that's something that I always try to get people to elaborate on to whatever extent I can when we're conducting an oral history, especially someone grew up in Meaderville, which was an Italian community. There, you know, are pictures, numerous pictures of it and maps. And you can see that it was a thriving neighborhood. They had a main street with, you know, dozens of bars and restaurants and churches. And there are famous photographs of the haul trucks backing up to this one church, and they just buried the church. They buried a lot of the town. But one of the most interesting aspects to me is that these people that grew up there, and there's a lot of living memory in Butte of Meaderville, they can never return because the very earth that the place is built on is gone. And so for the company to have taken a bite out of the city like that, I think the economic, social, psychological ramifications of that are still very actively felt. They're still very present. And
this was, let me just be clear, was because of the creation of the pit?
Of the Berkeley pit.
Yeah. Yep.
And so the Anaconda Company began to shift from underground mining to open pit mining, surface mining, mm-hmm. and which still goes on in Butte today. I think in a lot of people's minds, Butte's mining is historical, but in fact, there's an active mine in Butte. The Continental Pit is bigger than the Berkeley now, and Montana Resources, which is a Dennis Washington company, they mine 24/7, 365. And so maybe that's something we can touch on a little later as far as how mining affects the body, because there's all kinds of research going on right now examining what effect active mining is having on human health in Butte. But really, that's a topic that not a lot of people, especially in government, are comfortable having, because mm-hmm. you're talking about the primary employer in Butte, right. 25% of the tax base. Right. So there's a history in Butte of the company pretty much doing whatever they want unchallenged. And it's pretty well known, I think, that Anaconda ran the whole state mm-hmm. for a long time. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, there was a real price that was paid by these thousands of people and hundreds of structures that were displaced, totally destroyed, eradicated, you know, in the name of getting the copper out of the ground. So what I find most surprising, though, in these oral histories, and the more I do them, the more I learn that I shouldn't inject my own point of view in the questioning. But I want to know who opposed the displacement, like who chained themselves to their grandmother's home where they grew up, who, what kind of organized opposition was there to the expansion of the Berkeley pit? I can't find it. I mean, you know, people that we sit with and do oral histories, sometimes we'll talk for over an hour about, you know, just this idyllic childhood that they had in this ethnic neighborhood that's no longer there. And then, you know, when I say, like, was it worth it? And that, you know, yes, there were jobs in Butte because of the pit. People were able to raise their families, have a career. But, you know, the trade-off was your neighborhood is destroyed, so was it worth it? And most of the time they say yes. Mm-hmm. I just find that surprising, no matter how many times I hear it.
Yeah, and as you say, it was being done by the major employer in town. So people may not have felt that they could push back,
right,
or that the consequences of pushing back would be too severe.
Well, and so as a consequence, a lot of people just left. Mm. And also, surface mining requires far fewer employees than underground mining does. And so there are all kinds of reasons that Butte's population has been declining. Probably, I mean, arguably, it's been declining since the 20s. And that's another question that I ask a lot of the people that we're talking to in the oral histories, many of whom are over 70 years old and you know, have lived here a large majority of their life. I ask them, is Butte's decline over? And I'm in agreement with most of them that it is not over.
It is not over, which is a shame, I think.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about what you have been finding about the health consequences of mining that is still going on today.
Yeah, it's difficult. I'm not a scientist, you know, and I'm barely a journalist, I feel like, you know, it's kind of a hobby. But it's KBMF has given me the opportunity to produce more news, which has been really great. So, yeah, we've done a couple stories. You know, if you spend any time in Butte, especially if you're paying attention at all to local government, you're going to hear the name Ed Bandarab. And so 2601 Grand Avenue, he said, anyway, Ed Bandarab, he's a local activist. He's an older man. I'm not sure if he's 70 or not, but anyway, he's an older gentleman, and he is probably the most passionate advocate for direct democracy that I've ever met. And he lives in this neighborhood in town called the Greeley neighborhood. And the Greeley is basically just south of the mine. So, you know, over there in the mining landscape, it's a 7,000 acre complex. You have the Berkeley pit, which has 45 to 50 billion gallons of toxic water in it. And then to the east of that is the active Continental pit. And then between both of them to the south is the concentrator. So basically what they do, you know, they blast, they shovel, and then they load the trucks, they drive the ore to the concentrator where it's crushed in a series of mills down to a fine powder mixed with water and chemical mix, and then is agitated, and then they extract molybdenum and copper and other metals from that mix. And then there's an enormous tailings complex north of all that where that stuff is pumped. So basically what they're doing down there is grinding rock into a very fine powder all the time. And so people in the Greeley neighborhood, this initiative led by Ed Bandarab, are saying that that dust is hazardous to human health and that we're not testing for it properly.
So it's not just the people who are actively doing the work of mining. It's people who are like downwind of that or living nearby.
Right.
Kids, for example.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you talk to the local health department, they basically say that as far as they know right now, there's nothing really to be concerned about. But you can look into recent studies that have come out. Suzanne McDermott is an epidemiologist from South Carolina. Her son and grandson live here. Her son is an assistant editor at the Montana Standard. Mm-hmm. And she released a report demonstrating in her mind that, you know, cancer levels in Butte are elevated far beyond what is common knowledge around here. There's all kinds of seemingly indicators that active mining is having an effect on people. So there is no determination so far that's been made, certainly not something that's going to close down the mine or anything like
right.
that. And that's not Ed Bandarab's goal either. He doesn't intend to close down Montana Resources. But I think what we've observed at the station is that the local government is really reticent to acknowledge even the risk that the active mine might pose some human health hazard to the residents of the Greeley neighborhood or elsewhere in Butte. There's no doubt that historic mining poses a risk because lead and arsenic and mercury levels are elevated in people's attics and in people's yards all over the town.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I could go on and on and bore you to death with all the various aspects of this that I've learned.
Well, no, I'm actually really interested. Like you're touching on the pollution that was caused from previous mining mm-hmm. in Butte. In what way, if at all, have people organized around that to say we need to do something yeah, about this?
A lot has been done. I'm not trying at all to ignore the fact that a lot has been done. Mm-hmm. And someone to talk to maybe down the road would be John Sesso.
Yeah.
And he's been there for the entire process, mm-hmm. as has Fritz Daly. There are a lot of local activists, Mary Kay, Craig, mm-hmm. George Waring, on and on. One thing, though, for the sake of simplicity, I could just point out one program that is put in place as a result of a settlement between Butte Silverbow and Atlantic Richfield Company, so ARCO, now owned by BP. So basically BP is one of the responsible parties for the cleanup in Butte. As a result of an agreement, I forget when it took place, over 20 years ago probably, RMAP, Residential Metals Abatement Program. So now all you have to do is call this number at the county, and the crew comes out, and they test your attic dust, because mm-hmm. there were smelters all in Butte. And so this fine black dust is deposited in all the attics and all the residences and commercial buildings. And if that dust tests over a certain level, parts per million for arsenic or lead, then they come in, they vacuum out all the dust, and then they'll re-insulate for free. And so RMAP has been really successful and has been implemented in hundreds and hundreds of structures. And so, you know, if you think about little kids at home crawling around on the floor, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. the attic dust comes down. I mean, even a small amount of lead in a developing body.
Right. Especially when you're an infant.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're growing so fast.
So
it can really have consequences.
As Mary Kay Craig says, the body treats lead like calcium. And so as it is uptaken into an infant's body, then that child is more prone to intellectual disability or aggression which people jokingly talk about. Maybe that's why Butte has a reputation for being tough, is because everyone has lead in their blood and has heightened aggression. I don't know. It's not really that tough of a place. I'm not that tough. I do fine here anyway. But RMAP's been a really successful program. And it's an extremely litigious, complicated, decades-long process that's been going on. But Trump's EPA surprisingly appears to be the administration that's going to delist Butte and finally finish his cleanup and get a consent decree. So it remains to be seen, but apparently they're on their way to getting a final deal.
Hmm. Well, there's obviously been a long history of organizing on all kinds of issues, but especially labor in Butte. And it's worth noting that we are doing this recording in the old Labor Temple, which is still active as a labor hall. Yes.
Yep. And it's KBMF and five unions in this building.
Okay. And is KBMF doing other activities? I thought I saw something about concerts in the building, Dusty Hall concerts.
Yes, we have done a couple events upstairs, but yeah, mostly what we do upstairs is fix the place.
Okay.
The Carpenters Union Hall, built in 1906 on Granite Street in Uptown Butte, Montana, is the home of the Butte America Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit organization that's been working in Butte since 2013. Each year, the Butte America Foundation holds days of action in the old hall, working to reclaim the upper floors, which have seen decades of neglect. On Easter, the trustees of the Carpenters Union Hall, as well as volunteers from KBMF, the Butte America Foundation's community radio station, made a big step forward for the building, with the installation of nearly 1,700 square feet of new drywall on the ceiling of the second floor ballroom. This is only one step in a long process to bring back the hall, but a significant one. We'd like to express our sincere gratitude to ProBuild for donating materials and to the trustees of the Carpenters Union Hall, Mike, Jody, and Jeremy. Also thanks to Rodney Norman, Kevin Barnett, Daniel Hogan, Michael Scully, Jim Duran, and the Board of Directors of the Butte America Foundation. We hope you can join us for the next day of action, May 20th.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Body Politic. I am speaking with Ann and Clark at our neighbor community radio station in Butte. They have been talking about what it took to get this station going and why it is so important. Nice. I'd like to go back to, I noted that we are sitting in the Butte radio station, which is in the labor union. And then, Ann, you said that the radio station, the community radio station in Missoula, is also in a labor temple. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. When we were scouting for locations in Butte, Clark looked at a bunch of different spaces, but it was at And jump in if I'm telling the story wrong, but it was at Amanda Curtis's encouragement and her negotiation skills that landed us a space here. And she thought it would be a good fit because of the commitment to social justice and, you know, labor rights and all kinds of beneficial impact for people who are typically oppressed. And so that's how we ended up here. And then when we decided to build the station in Missoula, I had that as a model. And so our first stop was at the Union Hall, which is the historic labor temple in Missoula. And we carved out a space there. It was an office that was directly over the boiler. So it's warm in there, but that also made it cheap. And okay. So we cleared out that office and built a radio station in there. And the Central Labor Council was one of the original underwriters for Missoula Community Radio. And we have done a lot of collaboration with them. Mick Harsel, who has been involved in the Central Labor Council for, decades, was a presenter. He had a show called Ole Mick, Union Yes with Ole Mick. On our station from noon to one every weekday. And so he has since moved to Hawaii with his wife. They went for more warmer climes, but that was really important when we were deciding what our mission was and where we were going to be located. And we wanted to make sure that we had that component as part of Missoula Community Radio as well.
Okay. Well, so today we've been talking about three community radio stations, and I understand that there's actually a community radio network. Can you talk about that a little? What is the purpose? What is the need? What is the hope and the dream for this?
It was your idea initially, I think. You have all the best ideas.
I'm not sure about that, but yeah, we'll see how the network pans out. But my initial thought with networking all the community radio stations was that it would give us an opportunity to approach businesses for underwriting and be able to present a bigger broadcast area to them, frankly. So I thought of it in terms of fundraising. But you know, there are some reasons why a network is maybe ill-advised, specifically FCC regulations about how community radio stations have to stay independent. So I know Clark has done some reading and I have about how best to organize this entity. And so right now it's just sort of loose agreements between radio stations that, yeah, we're going to be in a network and we're going to share content. And we have yet to move into maybe grant writing or figuring out how to make underwriting work. But up to this point, there's us, there's KFGM, KBMF, and KJFK. And KJFK is in Hot Springs, and that's a community radio station that's the N of one. David Max plays podcasts from YouTube channels that usually are conspiracy theory oriented on KJFK, but he makes room for other content when we ship it to him. So that's what's going on right now. But, and maybe you can explain about our Native American station tour and the attempt to integrate other stations into the network?
Yeah, for me, the network, I guess, first and foremost, is about sharing content. So to see you all come from Bozeman, I think, is a great example of that. And it's just kind of starting, you know, because these stations are, like you say, pretty new and getting on the air, getting their feet. So, you know, only when we're kind of locally stable can we then, I feel, try and collaborate formally, you know. But like Ann said, there are restrictions on, as far as the FCC is concerned, about the governance of at least LPFMs, low power FM stations, which I understand KGVM is not, but our two stations are, and so is KJFK.
And also KMEH in Helena.
KMEH in Helena.
They're newly on the air too.
Okay. And KBWG in Browning is also an LPFM. So for instance, a board member can't reside, you know, can't participate on two boards simultaneously with these stations. So I'm not necessarily looking for multiple ownership by any individuals or anything like that, but just, yeah, agreements that stations are going to share content, and that if you have an opening in the schedule for a half hour every Thursday and folks in Bozeman are making engaging content, then we should send it to each other and air it, you know, on each other's stations. So to try and, I think Bozeman could use some, people in Butte could use some better information about Bozeman, because it's people mostly criticize it here. You know, that's really the only conversation I ever hear about Bozeman is negative. And so there's a program that, you know, features people from Bozeman talking about issues in Bozeman to better highlight what's going on that side of the divide. I think that would be a great thing to have on the air in Butte. And so there's all kinds of examples like that, you know, like Fort Belknap. That's a 90,000 watt NPR member station with incredible facilities and a really welcoming manager. And so I'm certain that there's content being created up there that will be relevant to urban Indians and, you know, other places in Montana. So, yeah, I want to find some way to some coherent way to share content on a regular basis. That for me is the first mission of the network. And it's already kind of starting to happen. And, you know, for instance, in Missoula, Amy Weiss is doing a legislative report on issues at the legislature that affect social services and mental health in the state. So we're airing that here, and they air it in Missoula as well. And so, you know, we're never going to be NPR, and I don't intend to be. And
that's not the purpose.
Right. In fact, we'd like to serve as an alternative to that. And so then maybe once all the various managers at the stations and program hosts become better acquainted, maybe even meet in person a couple times all together, then later we can move into selling underwriting in multiple markets where multiple stations benefit from that, and maybe collectively hire a business manager. So, yeah.
You've been listening to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. Today, we have been in Butte visiting with our neighbor community radio station, KBMF 102.5 FM. We have been talking with Clark Grant, the station manager, and also with Ann Salta-Petrie, who is a founding treasurer of the Butte America Foundation, which is the licensee for KBMF. But she's also a founding member of KFGM 105.5 FM in Missoula. I have learned a lot today about the importance of connecting from one community radio station to another. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.